Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
I'm Will Harris, and today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures.
Well, hello, and welcome to Chef's Story on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. And I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, the CEO of the International Culinary Center. And we're here today in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn at Roberta's. And I have another Brooklyn girl here. I grew up in Brooklyn. So here we are sitting on a very hot summer's day, first day of summer, with Daisy Martinez. And I tell you, we just walked into Roberta's and people were saying, I'm a fan. And so, Daisy, we're going to deliver today. We're going to talk about your background and everything you've done. For those of you who might not know, the few of you who might not know Daisy, Daisy actually is probably the foremost Latina chef in America. She's got three books under her belt. The first one was Daisy Cooks, Latin Flavors That Will Rock Your World. Daisy Morning, Noon, and Night, Bringing Your Family Together with Everyday Latin Dishes, which I have and cook from, I have to tell you that. Daisy's Holiday Cooking, Delicious Latin Recipes for Effortless Entertaining. But if that's not enough, she actually is a great chef. She's probably known for her TV shows on Food Network and PBS. She had Viva Daisy and Daisy Cooks. But she is a graduate of the French Culinary Institute, which is Yay! Now the International Culinary Center. And she was a private chef for 3 years in New York City. She was the prep kitchen chef for Lydia's Italian American Kitchen, which is really what got her into TV. And presently, she has her own small catering company, The Passionate Palate, and she has a very interesting website called mommyverse.com, and it's a website for young Latinas who are trying to remember those recipes that might have been forgotten along the way. So here's a woman who doesn't stop, and we're gonna tap into some of that energy right now. Daisy, hello and welcome.
Dorothy, I'm so thrilled to be here, to be with you, to be on Heritage Radio, to be talking about the FCI, now the ICC.
Right.
I have to keep making that that little distinction. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, now that we're the International Culinary Center, Jose Andres just joined to do. We're gonna have a big Spanish program, but Latina.
I worship at his altar.
We need Puerto Rican cuisine. And
that.
South American cuisine, and now we have the umbrella to do that. But before we get into that, I want to start talking to you, because when you came to start studying cooking, what were you doing before that? I mean, because you had four kids.
I'm the old lady who lived in the shoe. That's right.
Right. Were you cooking before you came to school?
Absolutely. I've been cooking all my life. You know, I learned at the knee of two very dynamic women in the kitchen, women who taught me to say I love you by breaking open something hot, blowing on it, and putting it in my mouth.
Oh, what a
I can't imagine anything else saying love and security to a child more than that, having your mother or your grandmother blow on something to cool it off and then feed you. And you know, to me, it became food became synonymous with security and love and family and just home. And I knew that I want to recreate that experience for my own children one day.
Well, were you professionally cooking in any way, shape, or form before school?
No. The only quote-unquote, I took a cooking class in high school called Gourmet Cooking. They taught us to make, and I remember.
Here in Brooklyn?
No. I went to high school in Staten Island.
Uh-huh.
Because I was born here in Brooklyn, then left when I was 5, and then came back when I was 17.
When you got sense knocked into you.
Thank you. Well, no haterade for Staten Island, right. But whatever. I love me some Brooklyn. I remember my mother was really impressed because my mother doesn't bake. She's never baked. And I made a blueberry coffee cake, and I came home with my little pizza, and my mother was like, well, we don't have to buy Entenmann's anymore. I guess I just shot myself in the foot, because there goes another sponsor, right? But that was my big foray, and we made blueberry coffee cake. We made brioche. And the other thing that I remember, we made a Dutch apple baby. You know that apple?
This is pretty gourmet.
And, and fried rice. Those were the things that I remember.
International gourmet.
Yeah, but that was it. That was really the only formal training that I had. But I always loved the kitchen. And I would read cookbooks for pleasure. And I would take cooking lessons that were geared towards the amateur, like at De Gustibus at Macy's, our Aline Feldman Selhack, our esteemed
Dean Alain's
wife.
Yeah.
This was before I knew that she was Alain's wife, but I, you know, and it was my way of keeping in touch with mentors like Lydia Bastianich, who I never missed. Whenever she was at De Gustibus, I would pay money to go see her. And
so how did you bridge into being a professional?
Well,
why did you bridge?
I think when my youngest child went into school, she went to nursery school.
And you have four kids.
I have four. I told you, I am the old lady who lived in the shoe. I'm not even politically correct. But you know, and that was a huge aspect of my life, raising my children. You know, I was a stay at home mom. I was class mom at one point for a child in nursery school, elementary school, junior high school, and high school. So I kept busy, and there was dinner cooked every night, you know, at home. But when I turned 40, I said, okay, now what? Now let's look at, you know, what's good for me.
What's the next chapter?
Yeah. And so I went to the French Culinary Institute. And I have to tell you, it was the most... the instructors used to say to me in the morning, did you leave last night? Because I was always the last one to leave, and I was the first one. I was the one who put the water on to heat and turn the ovens on. So I would get there. I would be there after the instructors left and before they got there in the morning, because I didn't want to miss a thing.
Well, there's a very romantic story here, because you used to come and eat at Lake Cole, our restaurant.
Yes.
With your husband.
Yes, yes, and, yes, yes.
And then tell... It wasn't really you enrolling in the school. You have to tell that story.
My husband gave me... the class as a surprise gift.
This is a huge class. It's this a professional program. It's an investment.
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, at some level it was. But I went to Le Col to have dinner, and I was sitting there having my champagne, and I looked over his shoulder, and I got might have been my first hot flash, because I saw Jacques Pepin sitting behind. He was actually hosting a dinner party for 10 that day. And they have that beautiful big round table at Le Col.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my, I can't believe I'm breathing the same air. I mean, you know, it was Jacques Pepin, Julia Child, and Lydia Bastianich. I mean, they were, yeah. I would watch the
Holy
shows.
Trinity.
I would read the books. I mean, the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
And I was like, I got all verklempt. I was like, oh, no, I have to go. You know, I'm like, I know that I'm like sweating or something. I have to go to the ladies' room. And I went to, you know, to powder my nose. And when I came back, I was like sipping my champagne and, you know, trying to like get back in my zone. And I see Chef Jacques get up from his chair and start coming over to the table. And I'm like, oh, my God, do I have toilet paper stuck on my shoe? What? Is my dress like tucked into my panties? I mean, what's going on here? And he, you know, I'm staring in disbelief. And he walks over to my table and he says, Ms. Martinez. And I don't think that I replied. I was trying to not drool. I think that was my effort at that point. And he welcomed me. He said, on behalf of the FCI, I want to welcome you to our class. And I burst into tears. I just didn't know what to do, to say. And I tell you, that first day of class, I remember when I got my whites and my check pants, my feet hit the floor running. It has been
and hasn't stopped running.
I'm telling you, Dorothy, aside from having my children, it's been the most gratifying experience of my life.
Oh,
honest
wow,
to God.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Wow, that I'm so happy. But let's get into your career path then.
Mm-hmm.
So when you got out of school, what was your first, you know, did you say I want to be this TV star?
No, that kind of like I myself, like I think every other graduate, you know, at some point has a romantic notion about having a little bistro with 30 covers where, you know, you're in the back with your hair tied up. But 2 weeks after graduation, I would check the job menu religiously. 2 weeks after graduation, I saw an ad in the menu for a recipe tester and kitchen assistant for a celebrity chef. I had no idea who it was. But I said, okay, you know, I still had, young ones in the house, and I knew that I couldn't get into a commercial situation immediately because that is really strenuous. You're really married to that. And but I was still high off that FCI buzz. I knew I wanted to work. So I answered the ad, and it was a gentleman by the name of Chris Styler, who you may be familiar with. Mm-hmm. He he's collaborated with everybody. He's a brilliant, brilliant chef in his own right. Mm-hmm. Chris is a really funny guy. He's also editor at large for Food Arts magazine. I mean, his pedigree is amazing. He worked for Julia Child. He was he worked for Bruce Springsteen. He was his personal chef at one point. I was like, wow, I need to get this boy drunk and get some stories, right? No, but Chris is a tomb. So I met Chris, who happened to live in Brooklyn at that time, and to be interviewed. And, you know, he hired me on the spot. And I said, so who is it that I'm working for? And he said, well, we're going to be testing recipes for Lydia Bastianich's Italian-American Kitchen, a new book that she has coming out that's a companion to a show that we're going to be shooting shortly. And if it works out with your recipe testing, we might take you on to do the show. And I was like, okay, I can do that. You know, I mean, I would have paid money to Lydia Bastianich
to do that.
Exactly. So I couldn't imagine. This was like I died and went to heaven. So I worked with Chris closely with Chris, and he was happy with my efforts. Again, thank you, FCI. And when the time came to go into studio to shoot her show, she shoots out of her house. She's got this gorgeous home out in on Long Island, right on the water. They invited me back. And of course, well, it's one thing to test recipes for her, quite another thing to be in her home shooting a show in her presence. You know, actually,
how hard is it to shoot a show like that? I mean, people, it looks like she does it 1, 2, 3 and so effortless.
Well, you know, the editor and the director said to me, if it doesn't end up in the show, it never happened. And you've, right, Dorothy? Right, I mean, you've shot shows too. You know that anything and everything can and go wrong. Gremlins come into the kitchen and, you know, burning sage and calling the shamans down to work their mojo. Sometimes you just can't get it to click. But
Did you get the bug then? Because after that, you went out and you became a private chef. And,
yeah, well, yeah. It was really funny. During that first production, and I was there working 6 days a week, probably for about 3 weeks, it took to shoot all of her shows. And during that shoot, Chris sent me downstairs with a tray of something. I think it was a lasagna. And because you twin out stuff so that we're not sitting there waiting for 45 minutes for something to bake. Lydia is assembling it downstairs in front of the camera. And then her mother has like a little apartment attached to the house. We would be in her kitchen duplicating the recipes in various stages. In case any gremlins showed their faces, we'd be able to swap out and we wouldn't have to start all over again. Mm-hmm. You better than anybody else knows that studio time is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So you have to be ready for any eventuality. Mm-hmm. And learning that from Chris made my experiences later on when I was shooting a show myself a lot easier because I knew the process from the back of the house. Mm. But during this one episode, I was asked to bring this tray of something downstairs, and I had to bring it onto the set, and I was in front of the camera, and the people in the back in the control room said, "Wait a minute, who's that?" Unbeknownst to me, this all became known to me later on, but that day at lunch, I found myself sitting next to the executive producer of the show, who you know, Jeff Drummond, yeah, mm-hmm. from A La Carte. Mm-hmm. And we started chatting, you know, just very conversational stuff. And he said to me, what kind of food do you do? And I said, well, I do all kinds of food. You know, I just graduated. I've been classically trained in French cuisine at the French Culinary Institute. But, you know, I've been married to an Italian for longer than I can remember. I can do Italian food, but I love Asian food. I read cookbooks for leisure. I mean, that's what I do for fun.
And your DNA is Latina.
But that's my comfort zone. So he said, well, Latin food, he says, isn't that like all brown? And I said,
did he really?
Could you imagine? I was like, boy, you don't know what you're talking about.
Slap him.
I mean, my God, talk about color and vibrancy.
Wait, okay. We're gonna take a break here, but we're gonna come back and talk about your amazing ride on television and into, you know, stardom.
White Oak Pastures is a 146-year-old multi-generational family farm that works in cooperation with nature to produce artisan meat that is safe, healthy, nutritious, and good to eat. Without fail, we ensure that our production practices are economically practical, ecologically sustainable, and that the animals are always humanely treated. We never falter in our determination to conduct our business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Well, welcome back. This is Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton talking to the irrepressible, inimitable Daisy Martinez. So, Daisy, we were just talking about you having worked on Lydia Bastianich's show, and it's how you got your shoe into the door of TV cooking. Mm-hmm. So they discovered you. It was like the girl in the candy, you know, in the candy shop in Hollywood.
Yeah.
You got discovered. So where did it go from there? And did you have any trepidation about becoming the next TV network star? And
well, I don't know. It didn't start out like that. You know, I had on-camera experience. I'd done commercials.
You were a model, weren't you?
Yeah, I was.
She's gorgeous.
Well, gorgeous is very generous, but you know, hair and makeup and really good lighting is all I have to say. But I've never felt uncomfortable in front of a camera because I had experience doing that before. So it seemed to me that when this opportunity came to me, everything, you know. Everything that I had been doing came to an apex. It just came together. The food, the media, everything. I was at the right time, at the right place at the right time. Everything. And it was like, you know, a host of angels just sang, you know, and blew trumpets and stuff. It was great. But I it didn't happen overnight. That was right out of graduation. I graduated in 2000. And between then and between the time that Daisy Cooks came out on PBS, I actually came back to work for two more productions for Lydia, mm-hmm. on subsequent seasons of her shows. And I worked as a private chef in New York City for mm-hmm. you know, very upscale family. And that was an experience.
Tell us, what's it like to be a private chef?
Well, you know... I think I drew on my experiences as a mother, because really it really is, you're taking care of a family very much, you know, and you have to take into account their likes and their dislikes. And a lot of the time, you know, when you're in a situation like that, you try to make yourself as invisible as possible, because after all, you are in somebody's home. And so you don't want to seem intrusive. You want to seem nurturing, but not intrusive. But you know, it's something where you really have to have the personality for it. I don't think that anybody can do it. A lot of times, because I was a mother, I had to bite my tongue because I have right. strong You're opinions about
child rearing,
yeah, and stuff like food, you know. Mm-hmm. But you know, at the end of the day, it was a great experience to me. I got to meet a lot of people. It, you know, it taught me a lot of lessons in patience and in my own strengths and weaknesses.
But then you bop back into media.
Yeah, well, all this time, I was, you know, I was in talks back and forth with Chris Styler and Jeff Drummond about, you know, about this production that they were talking about. And so we spoke about starting to get an outline together for a book, because if we could do the shows from the recipes in the book, we'd be killing two birds with one stone.
So the book came first.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes. We
and it was Latin. They wanted
it was
Latin.
No. It was what I loved to do. It was my comfort zone. You know, I started compiling recipes that were important to me, my family, that I have a very emotional connection to. Food has to make sense to me emotionally. I was once talking to another mentor, Douglas Rodriguez, who, you know, the king of Nuevo Latino. And I said, Doug, you know, I love you, but really, foie gras and tostones, I am just not getting that. I'm not feeling it. I need ajo mojito on my on my tostones, you know. But that's just me, you know. That's just me. The food that you know, I could do French cassolette because it reminds me of my mother's Puerto Rican white bean stew. You know, it I'm connected to it. It brings memories out for me. So you know, all of that was important in getting to, you know, writing the outline and doing recipes that were relevant to me somehow. Mm-hmm. And once I had the outline down for the book, then we just plucked recipies from that book, and then we had the shows.
So was the show just like rolled out, or did you have to go and find sponsors? Because the big thing with PBS, it isn't like, oh my gosh, you know, you're so talented. Oh, here's your show.
Yeah.
PBS doesn't pay you to do the show. You got to go out and find the money.
Right.
And do it. So did the producers go out and find the money, or did you have to go find
the
money?
Well, I think it was a combined effort. You know, there was a lot of meetings. Mm-hmm. I was a part of a lot of those meetings. Mm-hmm. And what you have to do is you really have to get these people excited, mm-hmm. That they'll benefit from getting behind this vision that you have.
Right.
And it's not an easy thing to do. Because
and what's the pay scale for the star of the show?
It's PBS.
It's right. Exactly. I think people think, oh my gosh, you're a TV star. And as everybody says, if you're going to go on TV, you have to have something else to sell.
Exactly.
Like the book. Right? That's why there's so many books with shows.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's not, you know, it's PBS. You're doing it really for the love of the craft. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was the opportunity to get Latin food out there in a way that, because, you know, Dorothy, here in the United, in the mainstream in the U.S., people hear Latin food and immediately the mindset goes to Tex-Mex, not even real authentic Mexican food, which in itself is rich in history and heritage and flavor, and it's healthy, actually, not like the stuff that we have here in the United States.
And take a foodie like Jeff Drummond, who says brown food.
Absolutely.
So wait, why don't you give us and the listeners, what's to you a definition of Latin food? Is that too broad a statement? Do you have to go into Puerto Rican food or Mexican food? Or can you give a definition?
It's all of that. It's the food of Latin America, which encompasses the Caribbean, South America, Central America. And I always give a tip of the hat to the mother, Spain, because that's what Latin America has in common. We all have that in common. We have the indigenous. We had the Africans that were brought over against their will, and then we have the occupation of Spain by said country. And the way that the food is reflected today really mirrors the ratio.
Influence.
Yeah, the ratio of those influences. Like, take Brazil, where it was like really, really heavy African and Portuguese. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, if you go to, I have a very good friend who's an author, Esmeralda Santiago, who went to Africa on a book tour, and she came back. She said, my God, all of the stuff that we make in Puerto Rico, they have there. You know, all of the root vegetables. Well, guess what? Guess how they got over there, you know?
Yeah.
And all of that is reflected in the food today. Someplace like Argentina, which is like so European. You go there. I had more pasta while I was in Buenos Aires than I eaten in Bay Ridge. And that's saying something. I mean, it's really, really Italian and German cuisine is really, really to the forefront. So it really reflects how those ratios panned out.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. So with the growing Latin population in the United States, do you think we're going to see more and more Latin restaurants?
Oh, absolutely.
That you know, mainstream other New Yorkers of other ethnics. Now like Italian restaurants.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think we're seeing that now, and we're seeing the differentiation of all of those Latin American cuisines. We have people, I mentioned Doug Rodriguez, but then you have Aaron Sanchez. You have Gaston Acuria from Peru, which, yeah. Hello, Peru. Peru is kicking some major food butt.
Yes.
You know, on the foodie trail.
You know, it's avant-garde. All the top chefs right now are going to Peru.
Absolutely.
They're not going to France.
Yeah.
They're going to Peru.
Yeah.
I don't know. What's down there?
Well, everything. If you haven't...
Why is Peru such a great...
They have 4,000 different types of potatoes. Let's start there. I can tell you the chiles, that it's beautiful. Let's talk about ceviche. Ceviche, I love to call Latin sushi, but yeah,
yes,
right,
it is.
But what's healthier than that? Mm-hmm. The food of Peru is very grain conscious, quinoa. They have a grain down there, a little tiny baby legume called tarwi, which I found out are baby lupini beans, which they, oh God, Dorothy, it's so delicious. They serve it in cold salads. I ate my body weight in lupini while I was down there.
Can we get them here?
I can't find them, but I've adjusted the recipe with regular lupini beans that you can find in Italian markets, mm-hmm. to mimic the recipe. Of course, the baby ones are a lot more tender. It just means you have to soak those lupinis overnight, and then you got to boil them three times. You got to change the water. It's a production, but the taste, it's well worth the effort.
You need a TV show with a cast of thousands behind you.
And hey, talking about Peru, llama. Have you eaten llama meat?
No.
Delicious.
Really?
Delicious.
What does it taste like?
It tastes like the finest beef you've ever had. Not as beefy. Think veal.
Oh.
But darker in color. And cholesterol-wise, it's healthier.
Mm. Is that a common thing for them to eat down there?
Llama is everywhere. Loin of llama. Is roasted, broiled, sauteed. Also on the menu, I tried it while I was down there. Can't say that I'm a huge fan, is gui, which you know is guinea pig.
Oh.
They serve
no,
that.
I didn't know, but now I know.
That's also a very cheap source of protein for them. They actually have
farms.
So
why aren't you... Is it a guinea pig pig, or is it more fowl?
More... think rabbit, like that, but a lot gamier and oilier than rabbit. You know, rabbit meat is pretty lean.
I see.
I tasted it because I went in Rome, you know?
Yes.
And if I'm going to talk about it intelligently, I have to.
Out of all of the Latino cuisines, uh-huh. Do you have a preference?
Which one of my children do I love most, yeah. Dorothy? The food of Spain is so romantic. Mm. Barcelona, I ate my way from one end of this. They're still talking about my kids. I went there with three teenage boys. They pretty much raised the city. The food of Peru is magnificent. Their rocoto peppers, these beautiful big red fiery peppers that they serve stuffed with meat picadillo. It's just
good.
Wonderful. Argentina, the most delicious gnocchis that I had. I had in Argentina.
Is Argentina more Italian than Spanish?
It's more Italian. I would say it's the one country that I went to where rice wasn't the starch. Everywhere else you get that rice thing, but in I'm telling you, more pasta than Bay Ridge. That's saying something.
Bay Ridge, for those of you listening in other countries, is another part of Brooklyn here, but it's heavily Italian.
Heavily Italian.
Heavily Italian. Okay, well, we're going to take another little break here, and we're going to come back and talk more with Daisy Martinez.
Thank you.
waiting for that White Oak Farm guy. I just want to have a mint julep with him sometime. His voice, I love it. Anyway, here I am, Dorothy Cann Hamilton of Chef Story, and I've got an incredible chef with me today, Daisy Martinez, who is probably the most well-known Latina chef in America, and we've just gone through South America, and she has me salivating over all of those foods. And so, Daisy, I want to ask you a couple of things. You didn't take the route of going into a traditional restaurant. Mm-hmm. And is it harder to be a media chef with TV and books and public appearances or working behind the line with a team and a group? I mean, there's a real family atmosphere in a restaurant. And what you do, I think, is much lonelier in a way. So how would you compare those two experiences?
First of all, I have to give props to women who work the line, because it is not a glamorous job. It is a hard job, and kitchens are still male dominated. And when you walk into a commercial kitchen, you have to have a thick skin. You know, I've stodged at different restaurants, and it's difficult. You really have to have your cojones in a good place.
It's a macho locker room.
It really is. It really is. So you know, people like Chef Carmen Gonzalez and Chef Gabrielle Hamilton and Alex Guarnaschelli and all those women that, you know, it's really funny, because when you walk into a kitchen that's run by a woman, the vibe is completely different.
Really?
It's like, okay, there's estrogen ruling this roost.
Right.
Yeah, it's not, it's a very, very different
vibe. Well, there's
vibe.
Silly things, like Alex Guarnaschelli told me that when she was in France, the men wouldn't go to the bathroom, you know?
Right.
And, you know, and you're sweating and you're not drinking enough water.
Right.
And she wound up getting kidney stones because she wanted to be like the guys and not drink the water and show how macho they were.
Well, you don't have to show how macho, just show how smart you are. Go ahead and drink that water. They don't have to drink water if they don't want.
That's
and
right.
You know, but you know, take care of yourself. But you know, that being said, when you are in a commercial kitchen, you are it is very much a team effort. Everybody relies on everybody else. Everybody is a link in that chain for the restaurant to run smoothly from the front of the house to the back of the house. When you're a media person, there's a lot resting on your shoulders. And that's kind of what I felt when I did my first show, when I did Daisy Cooks. I remember and I'll never forget this. I was doing a dish from Spain called chicken and figs. And you have to brown the chicken and you have to deglaze the pan and Saint-Ger and the whole nine yards. I Saint-Gered I floured my mirepoix, and instead of deglazing with the brandy, I put the I was making an espagnol sauce, one of the classic sauces. I put the stock in, and I stopped. And I looked into the camera, and I must have looked like a deer caught in the headlights, because everybody came running out of the control room, you know? And I was biting the inside of my mouth saying, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry. What kind of an idiot doesn't deglaze the pan? You had the brandy right there, you know? And my director, Herb Sevish, which is, he's a brilliant guy. He does America's Test Kitchen to this day. Mm-hmm. Took me aside and he was like, listen, it's okay. If it doesn't make it to the end, to the final tape, it never happened.
Yes.
It never happened. He said, there are 25,000 chefs who, doing what you just did, would have never forgotten to put the brandy in, to deglaze that pan. Out of those 25,000, how many do you think could do what you're doing right now in front of a camera? And I was like, okay.
No, but it's true. You know, there's a lot going on you, and it's just you out there.
Yeah.
So the stress level, you might have a big stress level in a kitchen.
Yeah. But you know that you're well supported. When you're in front of a camera, I felt there was a whole lot more responsibility laying on my shoulders because you're carrying it. You know, you're carrying it. People are going to tune in for you.
Right.
And for your recipes and for your food and for the stories that you tell and for the relationship that they develop with you. Because it really becomes something really personal, Dorothy. People stop me in the street and are like, oh my God, I feel like I know you. I had one girl that I was doing a book signing and she came up, it was her turn online, and she gave me her cell phone. She goes, that's my father in Puerto Rico and he wants to know why you add milk to your pasteles recipe. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
What? You know, I'm talking to him in Puerto Rico. But people really feel like they have a personal relationship with you, you know, from this
thing
on
television. And especially the type of food that you cook, which is personal.
It is.
Very adaptable to the home and so exciting. And you know, people do want to share. Now, I want to get into what's the future for Daisy, because you are just one ball of energy. And, you know, we don't see each other all that often. But
well,
we
you're
did
a busy
cross,
girl, too.
But we did cross paths, and there you were at the school taking another course. And it's like, where, and in wine. So where is this going, Daisy?
Well, you know, it seems to me it makes sense. I was actually part of the inaugural sommelier class at, I keep calling it it'll always be the FCI for me, you know.
International Culinary Center.
It was an amazing experience for me. And what goes with food but wine? I mean, it's a marriage made in heaven, right? And it was always something that I felt a little bit intimidated by. I would go to a restaurant and I would ask a sommelier for suggestions on what to drink with what I was eating, because it wasn't for me. It wasn't a strong suit for me. But after this this class, and I remember at the orientation being told that we would be reading 2 to 3 hours a night.
Yes, it's a very hard course. It's to pass the sommelier certification, and only in 2 months.
It's 10 weeks.
10 weeks.
Yeah. So and then in a process, in a matter of 4 days, we took like 4 or 5 exams. It was like incredible, but we got our first 2 levels of the levels recognized by the Master Court of Sommeliers. We got the introductory and we got our certification pin. So, and you know, the other people that took the introductory.
You're a certified sommelier.
I am a certified
sommelier. All right, girl. You know, I should know this. The course is at the school, but that was amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing. I have to give a shout out to Scott Carney, who runs the program. That man is 20 kinds of amazing.
Yeah.
Fred Dexheimer, Laura Maniak from Cork Buzz, who were our instructors, and oh my gosh, it was we started drinking at we started tasting. We started tasting at 9 o'clock in the morning.
This is a fun course.
Yeah, no, it's a great course, and you know what I learned from this course, Dorothy, is really funny. But when I learned to taste wine correctly, I immediately felt guilty for all of the wine that I've quaffed all of these years.
Really,
just drank without really experiencing the joy of the wine. And I know that I'll never do that again. And now I'm insufferable when I go out with my friends because I have to break down the wine with them. They're like, can you shut up and drink? Just drink your Lambrusco with your pizza.
Right. Remember, alcohol is a component, and that can be enjoyed too.
Absolutely.
Right.
But
So what made you want to be a sommelier after you're just like racking up all this intelligence?
I hope that I never stop learning.
Right.
I hope that I never stop learning. There are so many courses now available at the FCI. Aside, you know,
you sound like a running ad for the FCI. We don't mean to do this.
No, and here's the funny thing. This is like me on the outside, because whenever I talk, I wouldn't be sitting in front of you here if not for my experience at the FCI.
Let's move on to where you're going, because are you going to take your knowledge of the sommelier course and apply it to South American and Latino wines?
Absolutely, absolutely. I was actually asked by a Riesling company, mm-hmm. Clean Slate. The distributors were Winebow, which is one of the largest, and they have a very, very big presence in South America, which of course is the wine that I would love to get in. I would love to get involved with the wine of Latin America, because it would make sense to me. Talk about mentors, Nicolas Catena, when I was in Argentina. What a gentleman, and his wife, and his daughter. Did you know this? His daughter is an emergency room doctor in California for 6 months out of the year, and the other 6 months she's in Argentina making wine, Hello.
Wow.
She's amazing.
Double Korea.
She's amazing. But they're an incredible family. The wine of South America. Well, anyway, I went down on this trip and Winebo took me on. And I actually ended up doing recipes for them for this German Riesling, which usually paired with Thai food because it was spicy and thought to look at the food of they looked to the food of Mexico to pair with so I did a whole series of recipes for them for
and
a campaign.
And we should point out that winemaking in a very professional sense is relatively new to South America. They've
yes.
had vines for a long time, but even the Rothschilds, Lafite, has invested in Chile and Argentina.
Chile and Argentina, Uruguay is another.
That the wines coming out of there are amazing,
unbelievable,
and the price point, yes.
Cheap.
And the value, quality.
Incredible.
If you haven't been tasting South American wines, get out there right now.
Yeah,
Trust your palate.
I'm telling you, one of my favorite varietals is a varietal called Carmenere, which was a French varietal that made its way over to Chile after the phylloxera blight in France. And it no longer grows in France, but it thrives in Chile.
So this is the pre-phylloxera. This is what they used to grow in France, but because of the disease...
Right. It was wiped out in France,
but it's preserved
in Chile. And they're... Oh, my goodness. I have to tell you this funny story. We were out in the vineyard, and I was... The name of the vineyard was a Terra Noble, out in the Maule Valley. And... which was a lot of fun when I was studying these wines. I was like, I was there. We were out in the vineyard with the winemakers, and they were having a tasting. Amazing. And of course, when they would take you out to the vineyard, they'd have lunch. And lunch was this big, long farm table, and they were cooking a lamb on an iron cross by a wood fire. And that's what they were serving us for lunch, with like side salads. They had a chef out there and his whites. And they gave me this taste of this Carmenere wine that I had never, ever tasted before. And I tasted it. And I didn't know a whole lot about wine when I went out down on this trip, but I know what I liked. And I was getting secondary flavors. You know, you were getting a lot of dark fruit, and you were getting cedar and tobacco and coffee and chocolate. And I said to the winemaker, I said in Spanish, esto sabe a un macho con pelo en pecho. This smells like a man with hair on his chest, you know? And the winemaker said, well, you can come on over here and sit next to me during lunch. I think I want to talk to you. But it was such a masculine, such a delicious, full flavored wine. Mm. And I'm thinking, okay, a wine like this back home is going to cost $25 and up.
Yeah.
$13.
Whoa.
For a bottle of
so you're going to become an importer, I think.
I would love.
Let's put the word out here. Hire this woman.
That's
if
right.
If you can drink wine with like a man's hair.
No, man's
hairy chest.
Hairy man.
She'll write the ads for you.
There you go. But I actually have considered going back to Argentina. Don Nicolas Catena was like so generous with me. I'm thinking, Dorothy, maybe next year I'll go for the Vendimia. I'll go for the harvest.
You're gonna go and work the harvest.
And work the harvest. I didn't do
Good
it this year because
you,
I was
girl.
Taking that sommelier class, but hey, that's something that I might look into.
Okay. Well, we're winding down. Mm-hmm. And I just wanna say how much admiration that I have for you.
And
no,
for you.
Yeah, well, yeah. Mutual admiration society here. But I really think that you are one of those pioneering women, that you get something in your mind. As you said, you started when you were 40 years old.
Mm-hmm.
At the school, after having four children, still a couple of little ones at home. You know, Julia Child didn't publish Mastering the Art of French Cooking until she was in her 50s.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't start on TV till she was 55.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to say that you're a real role model in my book for someone who in their middle years, let's say, just picks up and does something different. And then when I found out you were doing this sommelier course, I couldn't believe it. Here's Daisy again, you know, 15 years later and starting another new career. My hat's just right
off
to you. And I want to know everything that you're doing. You have to keep us in touch here. And when you start this, I want you back on the show.
Awesome. Okay? Very cool. Very cool.
All right. So I just want to thank Daisy Martinez today for coming by to Chef Story. I want to thank our producer, Jack Inslee, and a shout out to my assistant producers, Heidi Tickle and Joe Sevier. Thanks, and see you next week.
Adios.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.